today on Against the Grain. What does capitalist power on the global scale look like today? How can forces from below challenge and overcome capitalist rule? I'm CS. We'll revisit a conversation with the political philosopher Michael Hart about what he calls empire, multitude, and class, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. 20 years ago, a book called Empire burst onto the scene, provoking a lot of discussion and debate. In Empire, two political theorists, Michael Hart and Antonio Negri, described the contours and characteristics of what they saw as the emerging global order, with its regimes of exploitation and control. They described, among other things, the role of national sovereignty in the capitalist world order, the ways in which forms of labor and production had evolved, the status of U.S. hegemony, and forms of democratic resistance, real or potential, to capitalism's operation and expansion. Recently, New Left Review published an essay by Hart and Negri called Empire, 20 Years On. Antonio Negri has taught at the University of Padua and the University of Paris. He and Michael Hart have authored Empire, Multitude, Commonwealth, and other books. Michael Hart, my guest this hour, is a political philosopher and professor of literature based at Duke University, where he co-directs the Social Movements Lab at the John Hope Franklin Humanities Institute. When Michael and I connected recently, I began by noting that he and Tony began their essay with these words. 20 years ago, when our book Empire first appeared, the economic and cultural processes of globalization occupied center stage. All could see that some kind of new world order was emerging. I asked Michael to remind us of what was going on in terms of globalization 2 decades ago.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you should even start a bit earlier with that. You know, think about the collapse of the Soviet Union, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the end of the bipolar Cold War arrangement. Because it's really after that that the George Bush father declares there will be a new world order. Like, remember during the Kuwait War, this was a... And what they meant by that, you know, Bush father and his people, was that they thought that now there would be a unipolar world. You know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there would be... The U.S. would now unilaterally be able to dictate global affairs. But in the course of the 1990s, I think it was clear to everyone, you know, remember the Clinton years, that capitalist globalization was taking a form that wasn't able to be dictated by the United States. And I think this was my perception at the time, that capitalist globalization or globalization as such was a question. You know, it was people didn't understand what it was going to be, but it was clear there was something in formation. So rather than the notion of globalization then functioning as an answer, yeah, I think that it was, for many different political perspectives, you know, those opposed to capitalist globalization, its great celebrators, I think it was still unclear what it was going to be, but it was a central topic of conversation, really in a widespread range of ideological perspectives.
Right, and... how do you think it evolved or emerged, let's say in the 90s and the early noughts? Like, what happened that made globalization a bit clearer to you? The outlines, the contours of globalization, capitalist globalization, as it emerged, clearer to you?
Well, one thing that was super important for me and many others was a very widespread social movement that contested capitalist globalization. You know, you could either date it from Batista's with the initiation of NAFTA or the Seattle protests against the WTO. But for a series of years there, in a variety of parts of the world, and I would link together with this also the annual World Social Forums, you know, which were first in Porto Alegre in Brazil, as another element of this, that these, I think that the opposition and the movements against capitalist globalization were what clarified it most for me at the time. And I think for many other people too. So that'd be the first step. The second step should probably be thought of, and this gets rather complicated, as the US war on terror, the post 9/11 invasions and occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq. And it seemed, I think, for several years to many that globalization was no longer a question. In fact, the old rules applied, so that it was now U.S. imperialism, the U.S. dictating global affairs. You know, this, and now I'm thinking of, you know, not only of Bush the son and Cheney and Wolfowitz and all of those who, the architects of these of the war on terror, but I think also for many on the left, it seemed like globalization was no longer a question. The old concepts ruled because, like I say, they had thought, and it appeared for some years to them, that the U.S. was really the able to dictate unilaterally global affairs. You know, now in retrospect, in the rearview mirror, this all looks like a very short time, because, as we well know, the U.S. occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan didn't prove that the U.S. is able to dictate global affairs unilaterally. In fact, proved exactly the opposite, that the U.S. is incapable today of acting like imperialist powers used to be able to, which is to dictate both politically, economically, and militarily foreign territories. And the U.S. was not able to do that. So then I think that that period may be why it became so difficult for many years to again pose the question of globalization, because during that period of at least from 2003 to 2007 or 2008, there was the appearance of, or I would even say the illusion of, U.S. unilateral capacities.
Right, and then there was the 2008 financial crisis, which maybe threw everything into question again.
I mean, I would say that the pretense of the U.S. to be able to dictate global affairs unilaterally was proven false by two primary, I don't even know if events, extended events, which, you know, the first, you know, militarily, politically, and even in other ways in Afghanistan and Iraq, and then also the 2008 financial crisis, you know, that both of them were demonstrations of the U.S.'s inability to rule the globe the way other previous hegemonic powers had, or the way the U.S. even had for certain periods, to be able to guarantee profits, stability, to act like a hegemonic power. So yes, I would say 2008, together with the failures of the U.S. in that so-called war on terror, and specifically in its occupations, the two of them together were a kind of dual demonstration of that incapacity.
And Michael, did you see these signs of U.S. hegemony on the wane right there? Failed imperialist adventures and the U.S.'s inability to sort of keep its economic financial house in order, as evidenced by these crises. Did you see this as confirming, in a sense, your and Tony Negri's original thesis in Empire that national sovereignty ought to be de-emphasized in favor of thinking more globally about a global kind of apparatus?
Yeah, we certainly did. You know, I'm hesitant to, it's hard to respond to things like that because everybody's, you know, like we're not alone in seeing these historical developments as confirming what we already thought. I mean, we're stubborn. I mean, a lot of people are. And, but yes, I mean, in the 90s, when writing Empire, our primary idea, or like the initial thought was that the U.S. is losing its hegemonic capabilities. And that already, you know, we weren't the only ones saying this too. You know, I remember Giovanni Arrighi, particularly in the book The Long 20th Century, he too, like us, had theorized that the U.S. hegemonic power had reached a point of inflection, had already shifted to what he calls its autumnal phase after the failures in the 1970s, the Vietnam War, financial crises then. So that in some ways, the end of the century was a kind of playing out, and this is the way we had read it at the time too, of the U.S.'s incapacity. With the difference for me and Tony, from Giovanni Arrighi, and also from others, was that our hypothesis then, or this is what we started working with and really what we meant by empire in the first place, was that not only the U.S., but no nation state will be able to dictate and guarantee global political and economic relations. So it's not as if, this is the way we're thinking of it, it's not as if, you know, Britain in the 19th century was able to do this and they passed the baton to the U.S. and if the U.S. declines, they'll pass the baton to China or some other nation. No, our idea was, no, we're going through a phase where it's not just the passage from one hegemonic nation state to another to guarantee the global system, but rather toward a new system in which, one way of saying it, like you mentioned, is that sovereignty is in the process of changing, that national sovereignty, which was really the basis of imperialist formations, the national sovereignty is no longer the key concept. There are many other ways that we tried to formulate this, but that's certainly one of them.
That's the voice of Michael Hart. He joins me on Against the Grain. I'm C.S. Song. Michael Hart is a political philosopher and professor of literature based at Duke University. And we are talking about an article he co-authored with his longtime collaborator, Tony Negri. The article appeared in the November-December 2019 issue of New Left Review. It's called Empire, 20 Years On, and that refers to his and Tony's book, Empire, which came out in 2000 and was followed by books like Multitude and Commonwealth and Assembly. Now, as you point out in this article in New Left Review, there are many people across the political spectrum who are calling for or heralding the return of national sovereignty. And of course, we can think of many regimes that are rejecting, at least rhetorically, multilateralism, that are pushing for protectionism and trade barriers and all these kinds of things. And certainly, in some cases, projecting or encouraging a kind of right-wing nationalism, a provincial nationalism. What do you make of those claims? Is it in fact the case that national sovereignty is now on the rise and globalization is on the decline?
That's not the way I see it, but I do recognize that's been a common way of understanding political developments in recent years. You know, either the return of the nation state or the rise of national sovereignties, and reading these right-wing developments that way. And maybe one should talk about it differently for the right-wing and left-wing, you know, versions of the wishing for or celebrating the return of the nation state. And generally, the right-wing ones, it seems to me, you know, America First type arguments in the Trump circles, and Brexit functioning a very similar ideology, etc. It seems to me that these are mostly a kind of trying to reassert in an impossible way, almost to reassert the privilege and prestige of nation states that are in some ways declining on the global hierarchy. So that it's a kind of nostalgic reassertion. I mean, with Brexit, it's even clearer than with the U.S. The idea that the reassertion of some separate British sovereignty will lead to either increased international power or economic prosperity or such things don't seem to me reasonable prospects. I think one has to understand them instead of the actual return of national sovereignty as the primary characteristic of understanding the international or global scene, I think one has to see them, like I said, instead as a kind of jockeying or attempting to jockey on the hierarchy of different nation states. You know, one thing I should say that had seemed like confusions for many years on this topic, and maybe it no longer is. It's occurring to me. For quite a while, it seemed like there was a lot of confusion when people talked about globalization and nation states, as if they were mutually exclusive. Like either there was globalization and therefore nation states don't matter at all, or nation states still matter and so there's no such thing as globalization. I think instead, and this is certainly the way Tony and I had always tried to formulate it, which is that nation states of course still matter, but they now matter in a different context, you know, within a global frame in which there are many other powers that condition them. Yeah, so it's not a matter of talking about globalization without nation states. It's rather, like you said quite rightly a bit earlier, it's about the waning of the sovereignty of the most powerful nations with respect to global affairs, like the inability of any nation state, this is the way I put it a minute ago, the inability of any nation state now or seemingly in the future to be able to dictate unilaterally global affairs.
Michael Hart, my guest, co-author of Empire. And speaking of empire, I guess it would be helpful to lay out your initial definition of empire in that book, in that tome, 2 decades ago. We can update your understanding of empire in a little while, but how did you define empire back then?
I think the most important way, of course, you know, like a book, I don't remember how many pages Empire was, but long, in a long book like that, we defined it a lot of different ways. But one, and that seems to me the most useful, is as a mixed constitution. And in fact, using the term empire was partly due to that. So this notion of mixed constitution is the historical example that we had in mind was Polybius coming to ancient Rome and celebrating the fact that Rome was not like other governments, like the idea and that what you have in all the ancient political manuals like Aristotle is that there are three forms of government. There's monarchy, the rule of one, aristocracy, the rule of the few, or democracy, the rule of the many. And what Polybius said about Rome was that it's simultaneously all three. It's at once the rule of one, the rule of the few, and the rule of many. So in some ways, we take this as a framework for interpreting the structures of the contemporary global order. Because in many respects, today, the contemporary global order was 20 years ago and remains today the rule of one. Like in military terms, in many ways, the Pentagon and the U.S.'s lethal technologies are monarchical. You can also think of as monarchical today, or often functions in that way, the rule of one, that the dollar on the international currency scene, there's a monetary and financial power of Wall Street or the dollar that can function that way monarchically. On the other hand, and maybe more important, there are aristocratic powers that rule the world. In other words, an interplay of the rule of the few, the major transnational corporations. You could think of this way. The major dominant nation states functions this way. Major media outlets or corporations, you could think of this way. And then there's a third layer. We shouldn't really call it democratic. It's rather the rule of the many. The entire panoply of nation states could be here. Various forms of social media. So the point is really just to give a frame for understanding and interpreting both the changes and the intersection among these different levels of order. And one shouldn't think that contemporary globalization is only one of these, you know, as if it's only dictated by that monarchical pole, or even by just the corporations in the aristocratic sense.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Michael Hart joins me, H-A-R-D-T. He's a political philosopher based at Duke University, where he also co-directs the Social Movements Lab at the John Hope Franklin Humanities Institute. He's co-author with Antonio Negri of the Empire Trilogy, which consists of the volumes Empire, Multitude, and Commonwealth. The two have also authored the book A Declaration, and no doubt other pieces of writing. And we are talking mostly about an article that he and Tony authored for New Left Review called Empire 20 Years On. Right, the political possibilities. You're interested not just in analyzing the capitalist global order and all its features and spheres and levels, but you're also very, perhaps more interested in how people and multitudes and classes of different sorts can contest global power, the status quo, the capitalist world order. And maybe we should start with this question, which is, should the emerging global order and its, you know, associated networks of capital be seen as an offensive or as a defensive phenomenon?
I mean, you're pointing towards a methodological hypothesis that Tony and I share with others, which poses in the most abstract, I mean, the abstract, most abstract, I guess, slogan that we go by is that resistance is prior to power, you know, so that capitalist power, but also other forms of power, should be read in terms of their reaction to struggles for liberation. One formulation of this that had been important to me and Tony, and that has an Italian lineage, I guess, is that capitalist development has to be understood in terms of a series of reactions and restructurings in response to workers' revolt. You know, so that it's really workers' strikes that are first. What Marx says at a certain point, where there are strikes, machines will follow. Like, so that what's primary is worker revolt, and that capitalist development is forced by that. It's forced into technological developments, other social developments, etc. And I guess we put that in a much more general frame than it's not just capital and labor that we're reading this dialectic, but even globalization itself. Like, you know, you and I have so far been talking about globalization or capitalist globalization in rather broad terms. Tony and I are inclined to see not so much that, you know, there's capitalist globalization, then we have, you know, anti-globalization or reactions to it. No, what was first was proletarian internationalism. Like, proletarianism and proletarian struggles were the first globalizers. Capitalists and the world market, etc., are in some ways reactions to the forces of internationalism that sometimes function together with anti-colonial struggles throughout the 20th century. This is really a primary terrain. That they are really the ones that are driving the process.
Yeah, and by your emphasis on proletarian internationalism, do you mean to suggest, first of all, not just to pay tribute to what that movement or movements was able to accomplish, but do you also mean to suggest that internationalisms ought to be a key characteristic of any social movement going forward that has a chance to subvert the capitalist status quo?
Yeah, I think I would say that. I would say it the way you're formulating it. I mean, the only reason I'm hesitating and fumbling is that, of course, there are a lot of really important social movements that exist today that don't cast what they're doing in an internationalist frame. So I'm only hesitating because I don't mean to criticize them. It's not like they're defective or something like that. But I do think it's important to remember, I mean, both when you said, I like the way you say that we should, you know, pay tribute to, I think we should, not just as a kind of bowing down to our ancestors, pay tribute to the long tradition of revolutionary internationalism, excuse me, but also recognize what was so powerful in it. And in some ways, return to that. Or find ways that today, again, it makes sense to pose our struggles that way, not as merely national struggles or even, you know, struggles at the level just of a metropolis. Do that plus recognize ways in which they act at and construct a global level.
I know that there are a number of internationalisms that have arisen in the last decade or so that interest and encourage you and Tony Negri. Let's start with one that maybe people don't think in terms of political intentionality, which is migration. What role does migration play, in your view, in the maybe in the emerging internationalism that you find inspiring?
Yeah, this is one of the most complicated, I think, but also powerful. And like you're suggesting, I mean, what I'm asking for and what we're you and I are trying to think through here is like, what would be today something that would fill the legacy of the Bandung Conference in 1955 or the Havana Conference of the Tricontinental, these great inspirational movements and moments that posed internationalism, revolutionary internationalism, as at the forefront. So I do think it's useful and intriguing to pose various flows of migration in this way. I mean, on the one hand, it's clear objectively that flows of migration are the greatest threat to the world of walls and borders and the world of various sovereignty. I think migrations empty out the foundations underneath them. It's kind of like it's as if the sand flows out from the walls. So rather than battering down the walls, there's a kind of evacuation. This is what migration attacks the regimes, you know, the various regimes. And that way, migrations affect a kind of objective internationalism or internationalization. I mean, in the experience of the migrants themselves, the reason to hesitate, and you were indicating this a bit, the reason to hesitate is it's not as if, in a broad frame, it's not as if they are political projects like others. There's generally no conscious collective action, generally no organization of a political objective. In fact, many migrants, maybe most migrants, don't even see their actions as being political. They see them in individual terms and with very specific reasons. All of that is great and true. And nonetheless, I think at a different level of abstraction, there is an objective effect of migrations of undermining these aspects of the global system. You know, this is one of those times when, you know, generally I have very little stomach for, what do you call it? Is that not the right term? I have limited capacities for analyzing right-wing ideologies, especially today in the US, et cetera. But there's sometimes when the fears of the right, recognizing them, help us understand the power of what they're afraid of. And the fears of caravans, the fears of this undermining a white U.S. nation and a white Christian Europe, etc. Even when these are hysterical, even when these are panics, and they don't, in the form that they're said, have a great deal of truth, I think nonetheless it's indicative of something that is genuinely threatening their political position and their worldview. So it might be that would be something we could think about migrants too, that even when it's difficult to see migrants, and you know, not individual migrants, but the vast phenomenon as an internationalist force of liberation, when it's difficult to see that in direct terms, you know, maybe by passing through wing fear of them and of their invasions, etc., it might help us understand what the power inherent in the phenomena could be.
Michael Hart is his name, a political philosopher based at Duke. His writings explore emerging forms of domination in the contemporary world, as well as the social movements and other forces that resist them. We'll speak more with Michael after this short music break. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Michael Hart joins me. He's a professor of literature at Duke University. He has co-authored with Antonio Negri an article called Empire 20 Years On. You can find that in New Left Review in the November-December 2019 issue. And it refers to the article of that, the title of that article refers to his and Antonio Negri's first book called Empire, published in 2000 by Harvard University Press. It was followed by books like Multitude and Commonwealth that comprises, those comprise the Empire trilogy. Antonio Negri has taught at the University of Padua and at the University of Paris 8. So to explore the potential of today's movements, you and Tony trace two historical and theoretical passages, one from class to multitude, and a second from multitude to class, but not back to class in its original meaning. Let's start with the first passage, from class to multitude. Does this have something to do with how varied forms of work and kinds of workers have become?
Yeah, I would say there's two registers for thinking about this, and really for thinking about the concept of multitude as we've intended it or other people tried to use it too. You know, one is that it is in terms of work and of the working class. And what we wanted to emphasize with multitude is that the working class has to be understood as a multiplicity. Always so, but even it's becoming ever more internally diverse, you know, with a variety of wage regimes, different kinds of precarity, unwaged labor in the home, that we think that, you know, you could say in that respect, multitude means working class as a multiplicity, you know, emphasizing that it's not one, something like that. But we also mean this, and this is the second register, that one should not think working class separate from various other structures of domination and also movements. I mean, now here we're, you know, we were working from, you know, that's 20 years ago and continuing still a variety of other, what do you call it, theoretical perspectives that are recognizing the mutually constitutive nature of capitalist domination, racial domination, gender domination, and even a variety of others. It doesn't have to be a closed set. And so what the passage, the theoretical passage from class to multitude is not only thinking like in that one register, the multiplicity of the working class itself, but the way that the working class is mutually constituted with patriarchy, with white supremacy, and other forms of domination. And hence that the struggles of liberation themselves also have to be multiply constituted in this way. You know, so when we say multitude, you know, in some ways we're learning from and following behind a long tradition of theories about intersectionality that come in the U.S. from, especially from Black feminist authors as an origin, but then have spread throughout and become quite dominant within feminist theorizing itself. Maybe we should also say this, is that multitude is trying to name the kinds of subjectivities that are increasingly in struggles today. You know, like that we don't, that in some ways the activists are one step ahead in these regards, that it's not like a struggle, working class issue should be separate from a struggle against white supremacy and a struggle against patriarchy, et cetera, that these have to be thought and practiced together. So anyway, that's the notion of multiplicity on the two scales in a way that multitude is meant to name.
Yeah, and just to read a couple things from your and Tony's article that I think reinforces what you've just said. Moving from class to multiplicity means moving from a unified political conception based on a single axis of domination, that determined by capital, to a multiplicity, which also engages patriarchy, white supremacy, and other axes. And you also write that there will be no successful and sustained project of class politics today that is not also feminist, anti-racist, and queer. So the question you then pose, and it certainly makes sense to ask it, is how can a multiplicity, right, this diversity, decide and act politically and act in a effective political way? And you say, interestingly, that an answer requires returning to the concept of class. Returning to the concept of class as the working class?
No, pointedly not. And we're perfectly aware, I'm perfectly aware that there will be inevitable confusion about that. But, you know, we need to separate class as a concept from the notion of the working class. I mean, for me, I would say class means counterpower. Class means the ability to organize into an effective and sustained, you know, both threat to the ruling powers and able to pose an alternative. So it's not, I mean, and then one way that Tony and I try in that essay, and it seems to me a useful way of helping someone understand that, you know, that we might think class differently, is to recognize times in the history of feminist theory, for instance, where the term class is used to name the feminist subject. You know, so this notion of sex class, for instance, was not uncommon in the 1970s and 1980s among feminist theorists, not thinking then, obviously, of the working class, but of the potential of feminists to form a class. And similarly, in racial terms, it seems to me that, you know, that has in the past been thinking of race class, you know, not race and class, but race as a class. And anyway, in all these, what I would insist upon, and the reason I'm stubbornly trying to use the concept of class as something that's anterior to and more capacious than the notion of working class, is that I think class is, at least for me, the best way to understand the organized capacities in struggle. Like, that's what I meant by counterpower. In any case, if the argument that Tony and I are trying to make here is, you know, makes any sense, one has to develop, and this is what we're trying to do there, develop a notion of class that includes the working class, but extends much beyond it. You know, you could say, using a certain language, this would be an intersectional conception of class, a conception of class that is formed by multiplicities. The rhetorical structure that Tony and I use, which maybe we only, you know, there's a certain kind of Marx, background that makes us appreciate jokes like this, you know, that so we pose this movement from class to multitude, and then from multitude to this class prime, as the general formula of this would be CMC prime, which of course for us has resonance with Marx's notion of the general formula of capital in volume one, which is just the alternation of that MCM prime. But it's similar in the sense that this prime, you know, so in our case now class prime, indicates what you started with but transformed. You know, so it's not class that we started with, but it's a class that's passed through multitude, that's been thoroughly constituted by multiplicities, something like that. That's what we would mean by this, or what we hope to be able to construct, you know, conceptually with this notion of class prime.
I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. And my guest is Michael Hart, a political philosopher and professor of literature at Duke University. With this class prime, this notion of a multitudinous class or intersectional class, as you mentioned, there needs to be some kind of cohesion, right? If you're going to talk about class, then there is a necessity for these different multiplicities to come together. And in that regard, among other things, you emphasize the necessity of internal bonds of solidarity. What do you mean by that?
It starts really with the notion of the internal part. It starts with a passage from Rosa Luxemburg writing about the failed Russian Revolution of 1905. The book is called Mass Strike. And in a passage of this book, she's chastising the German left and the party that she's working with for expressing a kind of international solidarity with the Russians. And, you know, you'd think, of course, Rosa Luxemburg's not against international solidarity. Criticizing them for is what we're trying to call an external solidarity. Like what the Russians are doing, we want to offer them help or sympathy, but it's something different from us. And what Luxemburg says is, look, you have to recognize that what they're doing, what the Russians are doing there, is really part of your struggle and it's part of your history. It's not something separate. And so that's what we mean by a kind of internal solidarity. But this is just the same. I mean, Luxemburg's formulations of it's quite beautiful, I think. But it's the same as, think of all the examples. Here's just one part of it, you know, that feminists in the 70s in Europe, in the US, I'm sure elsewhere too, their criticisms of male leftists who express solidarity with them. You know, because, you know, of course, they would also criticize male leftists who don't, which, you know, of which there are plenty. But what it's a criticism of is the anti-capitalist men who think, oh, you know, like feminist struggle is something else and we should be allied with them. But they don't recognize that actually it has to be part and parcel of any anti-capitalist struggle. It's not something different. It's something internal to it. That's what we mean by internal solidarity. I mean, here's the easier way about it. Like any, I've been to Black Lives Matter protests in the last several months in many cities, actually, or three cities. And one of the things that's so wonderful about these struggles is the way they recognize the internal relationship among many things. You know, so it's not always, it's not just that Black Lives Matter, Black Trans Lives Matter. And it's also that in any of these movements, it's also a discussion about anti-capitalism. So it's not as if one can struggle on one front without the other, because, and this is now I'm going back to just classics of intersectional analysis, like the Combahee River Collective statement, you know, that these structures of domination are not only related, they're actually mutually constitutive. So in order to attack patriarchy, you also have to attack capital. In order to attack white supremacy, you also have to, you know, so that it's not, this is what we mean by internal solidarity. I think, like I gave the example from contemporary movements, maybe I should formulate this a different way. I was hesitating because it's one of these things that I say, and I know Tony hates it whenever I say this, but I think it's true, which is what I like most about the things we've written is their unoriginality. Like, I think when I'm most proud of things we've written, what we're doing is trying to formulate together what activists are already thinking and practicing. And so this notion that we're calling here internal solidarity is really, and even this formulation of a political subject, here we're calling it class prime, that is internally multiple. These are things I think that are not realized in movements, because the movements constantly criticize themselves for not being intersectional enough. But the desire, the framework, the end goal, I think, are completely embedded within contemporary movements.
This question of, like, for example, if you're going to say, and I think you kind of said it, that you're taking kind of what's happening on the ground and then talking about it. You know, it's sort of already done, but maybe you're introducing a level of theory to it. What do you see, stepping back here, as the value of theory, of looking at things kind of in a more abstract, conceptual way? How can theory help people who are struggling on the ground, precisely the people who you want to help?
Yeah, I'm not sure about, I just paused because the help thing didn't seem quite right to me, but it's certainly, I think, theory, the kind of theorizing we're talking about, like it's working with concepts, it's thinking in an expanded frame, and understanding how our immediate situation fits into a larger and even global frame. I think all of these are necessary for political movements and political actions. These, I think, do always require a kind of theorizing. But, you know, I would hesitate to say, or I would want to quickly add that, and maybe this should be obvious, that it's not as if, which we say that activists act and intellectuals do theory. I think, in fact, some of the most interesting theorizing, this is, I guess, what I was trying at with the unoriginal thing. I think some of the most interesting theorizing happens in movements, you know, that happen collectively. And so it's not, there isn't this kind of division. The kind of theorizing that happens in movements, it's sometimes in different register, but I think it's still working with the same ideas. Let me give you an example from some years ago. I mean, this is what I when I was thinking about, you know, earlier you and I were talking about this mixed constitution and this, in some ways, decentered, multi-level notion of contemporary global order. I remember in those so-called anti-globalization movements of the, you know, of the late 1990s and early 2000s, that's exactly what the movements themselves were theorizing or even assuming. You know, so even if it wasn't done explicitly, if they had thought that the global order was being determined by the U.S., you know, they should have been in front of the White House every week or in front of Wall Street. But instead, the movements were each weekend trying to illuminate a different node of this global network that was forming the system of global rule. You know, so one node in this network was the World Trade Organization. So one, it was a protest there. Next week, it was the G8. Another week, it was free trade in the Americas. And so each week, there was a kind of experimenting with, or, you know, a sort of a constructive project of illuminating these different governance structures, you know, varied governance structures that together were forming the a new global system. So it seemed to me at the time that just what Tony and I were out in one register of conceptual terms, you know, like with this notion of mixed constitution, but also various other theoretical endeavors, that the movements were doing a similar kind of work in a different register. That's the kind of thing that I mean. I sort of hope that people can profit from things that Tony and I write, but I'm much more focused on the other direction of it. You know, like recognizing how much we profit from participating in and understanding and learning from the movements. And I guess it, inevitably these things go in both directions.
So Michael, your notion about relating to these internal bonds of solidarity that you think need to be there. So for example, needing to understand that someone else's struggle is actually one's own affair and internal to the struggle that I think I am a part of. This seems to imply or require that people see others in a similar situation to oneself, right? That they're experiencing certain kinds of oppression that I am, and therefore we're all in the same boat together, and there's no your struggle is external to mine, and mine is separate from yours. Precarity. So could precarity, in the sense that many of our lives have become increasingly precarious and many of our work lives have become increasingly precarious, could that be one of the bonds that brings us together or makes us feel a certain kind of affinity or solidarity toward people such that we would be more inclined to see their struggles as ours as well?
You know, I suppose recognizing common conditions like that, you know, various forms of precarity, you know, precarity in labor, precarity in other life aspects, that could be one aspect of it. But my tendency would be to focus instead not on what is the same, but on what is different, but nonetheless, like I say, mutually constitutive. So like the various theorizing in over the last decades about a concept like racial capitalism is not to say that people of different races are in the same situation, or even that workers and people of color in the same situation, something like that, but rather that capital today, and white supremacy too, capital today also functions through racial hierarchies, and that race too functions through the hierarchies of capitalist domination, like that one can't understand the structures of domination without the other, even though they are different, maybe because they're different. I'd say similarly with socialist feminist notions, you know, developed in the 1980s about capitalist patriarchy, function in the same way, you know, that it's not about sameness, but about the, I mean, this comes back to this, what we were trying to get this notion of multiplicity, that these structures of power are internally multiple.
That was Michael Hart, Duke University-based scholar, writer, and political theorist, and author with Antonio Negri of many books, including Empire. We spoke about an essay entitled Empire 20 Years On that appeared in New Left Review. And that interview first aired last September 1st. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.